You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, my name is David Bryan, and this is Curiosity Invited, a podcast inspired by endless curiosity. Tune in for an open-minded conversation about interesting and important things. Hello and welcome to Curiosity Invited. My name is David Bryan. And yesterday I spoke with two people, Allison Park and Chris Thinnes, both educators, both consultants, and both deeply involved in what is known as DEI work in schools, DEI, schools and other institutions, DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion. And unfortunately, DEI work, diversity, equity, inclusion work, has been blemished over the last few years, mostly for political reasons, and we'll talk about that. And you should know something about these two people. Allison Park is an educator and now a consultant who works mostly for schools, educational institutions, etc., with adults, with kids, with administrators, with teachers. And Chris Thinnes, also an educator and now a consultant, and does a lot of work both in that field and others. And the two sometimes work together. And after today's conversation, I certainly can understand why. Really was an extraordinary conversation. I should say Allison has a degree from Yale and two master's degrees in education from Harvard. And Chris has a doctorate in education. I don't actually know where, but I'll put all of that in the notes for the show. We spoke about a lot of things, and I think it's actually part one of this because there's so much to speak about. But just to clarify for people who think that DEI work is just about race and identity groups and like that. DEI is actually, the root source of a healthy educational environment. Right? I mean, it's really about belonging. It's really about creating an environment where young people, adults, can feel like they belong, they are cared about, they're welcome, and that their ideas and points of view and feelings are taken seriously. So it is not about separating people into identity groups, although certainly that does happen, that does come up. But the research is really clear. If you want young people and older people to perform at their best in whatever endeavor it is, then they need to feel, if they feel accepted, welcome, not necessarily agreed with, but like their points of view matter, they will thrive. They will be at their best. And isn't that ultimately the goal, well, of all environments, we hope, but certainly of educational environments? We want everyone to thrive, to be the best they can be. My conversation with them, with Allison and Chris, was splendid. Again, I think there are more to come. And I hope you enjoy it. Countdown makes you want to see if you can get something in there just before the numbers go off. You know, it's very tempting. Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to Curiosity Invited. My name is David Bryan, and today I have the pleasure once again of speaking with my good friend, Chris Thinnes, who hopefully you will have seen that episode before this one, but you know, you never know. And Allison Park, who is the founder and principal, and are you the sole person in Blink Consulting?
I am. No, actually, I am the principal, and I get to work with Chris, and we have a data analyst doing all the number stuff for us in our audit.
Yeah. Blink Consult. Where did Blink come from?
It's funny because everyone wonders, is it the Malcolm Gladwell book? Because we've been around for 20 years. It is, in fact, not, although I've read and appreciated that book. It came from, while I was still working with schools, it came from just the idea that every time you blink, you can see something as if for the first time, which is super hard to do when you've already made up your mind about the thing in front of you. But it was that idea that it's that perceiving the world and other people is always an action that we are taking in this moment.
So is it fair to say that Blink Consulting is a DEI consulting firm specifically for education?
It is. Education has always been my home. I feel that way, Chris. I don't know if you, like, I feel like your career is so varied, and yet you are such an educator, all caps. So education has been where I focus my work. And while I've done work secondarily with community-based nonprofits, it's really about development of kids and youth and the development of adults in those communities. And DEI absolutely is the core, primarily because there is no way to educate a group of people of more than one. And by the way, even the interaction of a teacher and a student means that there is probably meaningful, impactful diversity just in that context. So it's not DEI plus on top of education, but it's a focus on DEI because I believe that is at the heart of not just education, but any meaningful human interaction.
That's interesting. And Boy, I bet
yeah, it's like David,
I bet
isn't
there'd
it?
Be a lot of pushback to that statement in the world.
So, and Chris, you got to jump in because it is the, like, it is a reframing from the idea that we're like, oh, add a DEI commitment, right? The intention, I think we could all agree, in education has never been to exclude children, has never been to make children feel like they don't belong, right? And from those principles, we can see that inclusion, fairness, the ability for every child to succeed are so obviously at the heart of education. The thing is, we've just come at it socially as if it's this afterthought and it's for an agenda for, you know, like those people we didn't expect. And what we're talking about is the fact that we're just recognizing what's at the core. But to your point, David, absolutely. This is like, this is not the cultural preset.
Well, it's also, well, Chris, you were about to, I can see your mouth almost wanting to speak, so go for it.
Yeah, I mean, just piggybacking on the point Allison already made without the intention to, like, reiterate it, but one of the things that I think has preoccupied both Allison and I, and I think to some extent you, David, too, is looking at the way that DEI work has been conceived and structured in schools. Our work is primarily, but not exclusively, with independent schools, but our preoccupation is especially with that. And, you know, recognizing that for quite some time, lots of schools add, you know, there's no shortage of equity initiatives, right, in schools. And many of them are, you know, heavy on initiative and light on equity. You know, a lot of rituals, a lot of shows, a lot of declarations, a lot of statements, some work with utter integrity, but not necessarily doing anything to really change the game. And, you know, one of the things that's occurred to us over time, which is either brilliant or idiotically simplistic, like, no idea. But like,
it's a big range. It's a big range.
Totally. Well, yeah. And that's the range within which I like to keep it on the rails. But the sense that, like, these schools are making these commitments, they're making these commitments to educational excellence, right? Like, teaching and learning that offers the mostest to all of the children. And then there's this other lane of, like, DEI work, because the proper business of schooling is teaching and learning. And it's also nice if children feel warm and accepted, you know, whatever. But in so many different ways, interpersonally and institutionally, these are like two separate silos. Like, there's the teaching and learning committee that meets on Tuesdays with those eight people. And then there's like the DEI committee that meets on like Friday afternoons in another room about its separate set of initiatives as one, you know, simple example. And to Allison's original point, I'm finally getting there. Like, our sense is that cultivating an intentional sense of belonging as best one can is actually fundamental to the teaching and learning part. It's not additive. It's not environmental. It's not to connote a context in which teaching and learning might be wonderful. It's to say that teaching and learning itself is fundamentally rooted in that work.
So this gets to why things are structured the way they are, because David, it's getting to work with people like Chris who help clarify so many things for me in this work that includes, so when Chris talks about that academic excellence pillar, what's really critical to understand is that is not a neutral agenda and that is not a universal agenda. It is an agenda that has created a norm, a default, an acceptance that Black kids will not do as well as Asian and white kids. It's a narrative that says boys will be boys and they just don't learn as well as girls do. Academic excellence is not neutral and is more than willing to leave children out of education,
right,
dislocate their well-being in order for institutions to be excellent. So we're not saying that educators are bad people. We consider ourselves educators too. It's just that the reason DEI has had to be added in is because somehow we have structured the house of education against a commitment to all learners feeling seen and being able to thrive. And by the way, educators too, we would say. So this is the truth is, it's hard to reconcile DEI at the core because we've built it to be outside. But when you really rethink education, child-centered is a popular phrase. When you really rethink that, and just human-centered, because again, teachers matter too, and their families matter as well, then you have to really recognize that it's not just a DEI agenda that's coming at schools, but there's an agenda that's been preset that we really need to interrogate.
I completely both get it and agree. And people want to get to the end. You know, it's like, hey, we live in a diverse world. Look, I can wear a blue tie and you can wear a red tie. And as long as we're wearing ties, we're okay. And I wouldn't want diversity to include everything.
It doesn't.
Right.
So, David, what you're hitting on is, by the way, like one of the things, I don't hear you doing it, but one of the things that people confuse diversity with is just differences. Like the three of us are different from each other.
Sure.
What diversity socially means is that our individual differences are a truth that are then correlated with patterns of identification. And by the way, this isn't just how we get identified, but how we identify ourselves, that then track with disparities in social access to resources and opportunities. You're standing in a community, whether when the three of us walk into a space, who's seen as being part of the group, who's seen as being respectable and intelligent, right? Those individual characteristics actually correlate with these disparities that are, again, identities that sometimes we choose, sometimes they're put upon us, that track with these disparities of experiences and outcomes. And so what you're talking about, what you're naming is, let's be very clear, education is persistently achieving racist, classist, and sexist and ableist outcomes, period. That's what we're talking about. So we're all in agreement that we have to address that. The question is whether you use, and I think this is what you were saying, Chris, an additive model. And think of like DEI as like a barnacle on the hull of a ship, right? And we're like, oh, the ship, like that's Chris, I'm translating the metaphor of silos. The ship is the main vessel and the barnacle is just this like DEI hanging on. And it's this committee fueled by like passionate people who care a lot, right? Whereas what we're talking about is actually redesigning the ship with this consciousness that it's not just about adding a program. And Yuri Treisman did some great work around this at Cal. It's not just about having trailers at the edge of the UC campus where kids who are struggling, you send them and the TAs will talk to them. It's about revamping how we think about and the responsibilities of educators, right? Because the problem you identify, David, is so core. It's not just about these patches and fixes and you know, I think about in a house like putting decorative sconces on the wall and stuff like that.
Yeah. So let me be one. Let me be the voice of. I should have said this at the before we even started, which is, so I might be asking some questions. They're really questions, and frequently they're questions that I don't even have, but I'm trying to give voice to them, and so there it is. So now you can't hate me. Well, you can, but you have to know me better first. But education is about learning stuff, no? I mean, like, so some people, well, here we go. I'm going to lob this over the plate. So some people are just way the hell better at math. They just see it right away. And some people struggle with words and letters and linking concepts and you know, ultimately a big chunk of it education is serving a society, whatever that is, at least in part, so that we can build on the successes of the past, et cetera, and so people do have to come out at the end. You know, they have to come out of a French class speaking French, and they have to come out of a math class knowing how to do this stuff. So not everybody's going to do it in the same way. And shouldn't we be spending time focused on how to do those things better? Or is that what DEI is aimed at? Not sure that was a question. Maybe it was. Like,
Chris, you want to go for it?
I'll start if you jump in and make it better. But that's a giant complex question, and I appreciate it because it's challenging. I mean, the things that are front of mind are, number one, by all means, education is about, you know, learning stuff, but also, it's not just about like the transmission of content or the transmission of a cultural inheritance from one generation to the next. I know all of us know this. I'm just kind of going through things that are going through my mind. It's also, I think, ideally, about knowing oneself and knowing others and developing the skill set to engage with others, particularly in the case of schools, around things like problem solving. To Allison's point earlier about academic excellence itself being in a way an ideological construct, like a term we all use in the ordinary sense of its seeming meaning all the time, and everybody seems to understand what each other means, like that whole notion itself, as Allison already said, is constructed in its way and has always, not recently, not certain crisis, but like has always produced inequitable outcomes for certain subpopulations, typically, but not always, framed by ethno-racial identity. That's just a fact of American education, as we all know. And so, in a way, the term I prefer to use is one that's been in circulation more recently, called deeper learning. Like, rather than using the language and seeming to mean one thing, we're trying to tip into like maybe changing the language with others to maybe mean something else. And just as an example, Maida and Fine, I think about 10 years ago, in Search of Deeper Learning, framed the characteristics of what we might call educational excellence, but what they and we call deeper learning, as hinging on mastery, identity, and creativity, right? So mastery is, there's going to be a very complex skill set involved in problem solving in the educational experience. and people are going to work together to come up with complex solutions to real world problems. And there will be methods of assessment to assess whether they have mastered skills, not necessarily content, though that's part of it, but whether they've mastered certain kinds of skills. Second, that the identity piece is that these things that children will be doing are meaningfully connected to themselves as individuals. They see value and meaning in the work that they're doing, and they see value and meaning because it's connected to a problem that they actually see or experience in the world, and not some abstraction of a problem about apples and oranges or a problem someone else somewhere else is allegedly trying, but that actually apply to their world. And then finally, creativity is rooting much, not all, but rooting much of that educational experience in collaborative problem solving, and kind of bringing it around like that is among the context for the reasons why we think DEI work and its hoped for outcome, which is a sense of belonging that each student experiences. It's hoped for, not chosen by us, but either perceived or not perceived by the person that we're working with or for. That knowing oneself, knowing others, and knowing how to navigate problem solving in a group context are just absolutely essential and foundational to the educational experience of great learning. So it's hard for us to take these concepts that traditionally have been siloed, right? Because we see them more and more and more as inextricably intertwined. And it's as though the whole discourse about it, whether it's the case that's made for DEI in schools, and more pressingly, the resistance that's framed and declared to DEI in schools, we just feel, as simple as it sounds, are framing the actual matters in binary terms with some kind of artifice. Like we can't actually see them as separate.
Not just like the artifice I think you're talking about, Chris, is the fact of when education becomes anti-equity and inclusion, that there is a degree to which education is against that. Because I'm thinking, and so by the way, David, I appreciate that you're like, emergent questions, because I'm like, definitely emergent thoughts. And I love the complexity of this. But essentially, like, so what you two are making me think about is, number one, DEI is always about whatever it was you were already doing. It is actually not its own work. It is like, it is as long as it's going to take to make it integrated into what we do. But I'm going to work with a board this evening, and I tell boards all the time, DEI is not this additional thing. It's about, what do you think your core responsibilities are? Strategic institutional stewardship, fundraising, board succession, like that's where this work lives. So DEI is always kind of like, and I'm not techie, so it's like, in a way, it's part of the operating system of a thing as opposed to the separate app that you're running. But currently, it's a separate app that we're running. And the conversation, Chris, as you're talking about collaboration, et cetera, here's the really funny thing about the setup of academic excellence right now. Teachers and kids are all thinking about those students who hold us back, the students who just can't learn, right? Like in group work, it's like, well, Chris never does his work, right? And there is no curiosity or space for it. There might be curiosity, let me say. There's really no space to center. What is Chris learning? How is Chris learning? Right? And that maybe this demonstration of being disengaged isn't because Chris doesn't care. And maybe Chris isn't the problem, right? And Chris, that's where you're talking about, like, deeper learning asks this question about really focusing on this engagement. So I'm thinking about, like, the fact that even having this conversation, and Chris, you were illuminating, like, is the objective, let's all agree, if DEI is about doing whatever it was you were committed to doing, then what is the purpose of education? Is it that kids all know a certain something by the time they're done, for example, with French class? Is it that if they ever end up in a situation with someone who speaks French or another language that they don't understand, is it about the habits of heart and mind and action that they bring to that? Like, even if I sucked at French, like, is it about how I show it? Because I watch people all the time have different reactions when they are in company with people who don't speak a language they can understand. And it's anything from intolerance to curiosity to wanting to engage to not bothering to talk to them. And so there's a question, what is the point of the exercise? Why is it, and this is what I'm curious about, why is it that we've set up and gotten to a point where we're blaming kids for like yucking the yum of other learners when like being good at something, because if that's the purpose of school, to support kids in whatever they're already demonstrating that they're good at, by the way, do we then give up on that as soon as the kid who's good at math until geometry, when they struggle at geometry, are we like, okay, you need to pick a lane where you're actually like good? And that, I think the fundamental question around DEI is, how do we be effective, which forces us to interrogate, what are we trying to do in the first place?
Well, so how do you do this work, you both do this work. So what do you think the goal of education is? And when you walk into either the board or the school district or the whatever, what is it that you start with? Do you start with the question of what are you all here for? What is it that we're all trying to do? And what if they say no, we're actually here for then so that people learn French or whatever the hell it is, right? You know, so that whoever can solve the problem of how to seed the clouds to create rain and get us out of this global warming mess, whether they work in a group or work individually, that's what we're here for. We're moving the world forward.
Yeah, absolutely. So first of all, we always do start with mission and your understanding of what it is you're here to do. Because it's not just education writ large. As Chris was pointing out, there are a lot of like particular things that especially, but not only independent schools, public districts also say they're about a thing.
They all said.
Here's my number one, yes, we are in this together. Okay, and I was actually talking to, this was a zoo that I was working with, an actual zoo. We were talking about here's the thing, there's this pressure from most organizations, including but not just schools, about we don't have time for this because we're trying to act.
Yes.
So I asked them, like, what do you do? What is really important? And it's conservation, right? It's not even just running this zoo. It's about animal conservation. And part of that is essential to like running the zoo so that people have these experiences, right? And so here's the thing, if we're really, and it's like the planet. So if we're really invested in sustainability on this planet and the survival of species in a way that is mutually beneficial, we need the best minds. We need like everyone to have access to this facility. We need everyone to have access to the potential to be hired by this place. Because we're not talking about being against excellence. We're talking about when a perceived commitment to excellence, which is often about convenience, throttles your access and to people who could enrich and be the solutions that you're talking about, David. Like, I just love what you were saying, right? Because it's not about dumbing it down. It's not about, okay, we'll just include everyone so that we can be nice. It's about the fact that when we exclude people, we lose so much. It's the Stanford, is it, Chris, correct me, is it the, it might not just be Stanford, but it's the experiment about like marshmallows and dry spaghetti and like building a tower,
yeah,
right?
Building the highest tower you can, yes.
Yeah, and all these studies that show that just getting MBAs from like the top school, like highest ranked school at the moment, that's not necessarily going to get you there, right? So that's what we're talking about.
I actually did that with, true story, I did that with, I was working for Snapchat. Well, now they call themselves Snap, right? I was working for, and in San Francisco, and I did that with a room full of coders, most of whom had PhDs in computer science. And it's like, we're building a tower. Oh my God.
Yeah.
It was wild, wild. And what they built was quite amazing, but you couldn't predict. You couldn't predict from who the best coder was to who was the best tower builder.
And so it's like you can't predict from the best French-speaking student whom the most effective translator on life and death issues.
Yes.
When in a negotiation about terrorism or war or famine, you're not going to be able to predict that directly. Sorry, Chris, if you were.
No, sorries. And knowing what I'm about to say, like I prefer your example because it's the high bar. Like it's all of these other reasons why the educational, what the educational mission is and why it's so important. But I also want to say, like, from a different perspective, and going back to David's original, like, hypothetical about you go into a place, what are you all about? And they say, we're about everybody getting a 95% or above on the French proficiency test. I can confidently say, and I'm not making an argument about the substance of DEI or education. I'm making an argument right now about, like, tactics to sort of mitigate this siloing between the two things. I can confidently say to that group even, well, wouldn't you know it? But based on all available research, that those students, a sense of belonging correlates with academic achievement, particularly, like, and most strenuously for those who report a weak sense of belonging, meaning those students who report a weak sense of belonging perform disproportionately worse than students who report a moderate sense of belonging. Then those who report a moderate sense of belonging perform as compared to those who experience a high sense of belonging, right? So if you want everyone to pass your 95% proficiency thing, one of the cheat codes is to do everything in your power to ensure that every child feels seen, feels safe, feels connected to people and to the organization, believes and is trying, if they can, to make contributions to that community because they feel a part of it. Those are the children who are going to perform best on the French proficiency test. So why don't we go about our agenda, you know?
It would seem to me, you know, because we live at a time, now I'm going to be me, but we live at a time when there's so much, you know it, you know better than me, there's so much pushback, dismissal, down talk about DEI, and we never actually defined the terms, but let's just assume for a moment that that somebody knows what we're talking about. It would seem to me that is the place to start, right? Because most places, I would say, you know, shoot from the hip. Most institutions, if you ask them what they're about, they'll tell you what they're about in pretty conventional terms. They're about being the best and making their kids the best they can be, and blah, blah, blah. And if indeed it turns out that the product of DEI work facilitates that, making kids helping kids become the best they can be at whatever their pathway is. It's like, you know, what? Look, here it is. You got the golden ticket. You know, Willie, you just pulled the golden ticket. This is the thing for you to do because you want to achieve this thing, which we're not going to argue about. Yes, 95 on the French proficiency test is a great goal. Good for you. I don't know if it's a great goal, but you think it is. And so I'm here to help. And that's why I'm trying to do this DEI thing with you.
So, I feel like, so in naming that example, I feel like there's some sense within education that you shouldn't say that. Like you shouldn't admit that what you're actually, well, you said it so nakedly, Chris, right? And it's like, okay, so we can work with that. But I feel like there is an imperative to not say it, at least in my experience of not just independent schools, but also public schools, that you're supposed to say something and couch it in like children's development, da 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 da. But if what you really mean is 95% on the test, it's so much easier to actually work with that.
Yeah.
Without the layers of an obfuscation that I think is well-intended, because again, people know that we're not supposed to forget the kids, but there's a level of pressure to do something that is working against that sense of belonging you're talking about, Chris, because I think about how with kids who don't feel smart, there's a correlation with not feeling like they belong, right? And the not feeling smart is because of the construct of what academic excellence requires of students in order for us to all get to say, this is academic excellence going on, in order for teachers to feel, right? So it's like that, like when you were speaking, Chris, I was like, so obvious. And David, you're like, it's so obvious. And I'm like, and it's so deep. Because it's not just being nice. That's what people, I think, stumble over, right? Like diversity isn't just differences, and equity isn't just treat everyone equally. In fact, that can be anti-equity, and inclusion isn't just being nice. It's about addressing the systemic and culture, and equity and inclusion go hand in hand. It's about addressing the systemic and cultural defaults that require us to campaign for them, right? Like we have to participate and carry them forward that help norm. I don't think you can walk into a school in this country and confidently say, there are no kids here who feel like they're the dumb ones.
Oh.
And I'm just wondering, like, can you imagine showing up for work and spending most of your time feeling like you're a loser, that you're one of the dumb ones, like you're not good enough? Like,
I guarantee you that's true. That is true at every institution of learning.
This is a great, like, this is the Curiosity Podcast. It's like, why haven't we created more space where the inevitability that we don't understand what's going on is like, awesome. And I just want to go back to, because I'm talking about like the kid, if this student got to the point where she felt unworthy, and that's kind of where I was starting. Yeah. This like feeling of not being smart enough that correlates with not feeling worthy for some kids.
Right.
Like, because hopefully all kids feel confused at some point. I remember telling my students, like, if you don't feel like you hit it out of the park with this essay, that's why we're here. That's why I have a job, because we're doing this exercise and communicating together. So if you were just like already able to do it, I wouldn't waste the time on it. Like we would move on to the next thing. Yeah. But this feeling of unworthiness, like I really just want to pause, because as a teacher, I was aware that some kids felt inadequate. And why is it? How is it that we're okay with this in education? Yeah. That we're okay that kids feel not good enough in their time with us.
And as you're speaking, you're both making me think of, you know, the way that this enduring myth of individualism plays itself out in this context, which is that having had the experience myself, I can say even more confidently than talking to lots and lots of kids who've had the experience that pretty much every child who feels like one of the dumb ones experiences that as a sense of individual failure, right? The system, a system always imagines itself as successful, with any outliers being to blame, usually individually, quite often by virtue of the identity group with which they associate themselves. And the system doesn't imagine that it might have failed a child, or that it has an obligation to mitigate that sense of isolation. And unbelonging, which is a term that Allison uses that I love, an experience of unbelonging in an institution. And so that's another reason for us feeling as though, like, until or unless we get down to those qualities and characteristics of an education that can mitigate us against a sense of a seven-year-old child having to be a failure in the world. And watching a seven-year-old child, which as I've seen over and over and over again, make decisions about the future possibilities of their educational experience or career or livelihood based on their experience of feeling like one of the dumb ones at seven, shutting down completely. Like these are actual traumas iterated every day. And I'm not trying to drag any educators. I'm trying to drag a system.
Chris, can I just jump in and say, not just experience that themselves, but when we go back to patterns, and all systems are perfectly designed to achieve the results they get. So we cannot problematize brown and black kids, boys, kids who learn differently than how they are being taught. We can't problematize them. So if I'm putting that kid that you're talking about, that seven-year-old, then imagine that somewhere in their consciousness, and let's just double down and say they've never been given the language or permission to name it, they're seeing it as a pattern, right? So this individualism is weirdly embedded in the moment when a student said to me, Black people just aren't good at math. I don't even teach math, right? But this kid was just telling me, like, I can't do this. It was a Black kid, right?
Yeah.
It is how individualism is confirmed by social stereotypes and norms that we've accepted to cement the position of the child.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's so, well, I don't know. This is maybe obvious, but it's so sort of Moebius strippy, right? I mean, it's the institutions then become this thing, and then we get this crazy upside down backwards system where we select the most high achieving, the highest achieving young people. I don't care what age it is, whatever that means, however one makes those decisions, we select, pre-select for those. And then the institutions are created and they pat themselves on the back for then getting everybody. Look, everybody get a 95 on the French proficiency exam. We do such a good job. What the fuck are you talking about? You selected for those kids. Like, why don't you take everybody and then see how you're doing? Because then maybe you'll be better at the thing that you say you want to be doing, which is educating people.
And then again,
wacky.
And then how do we stunt the growth of kids when what we want them to do is perform to a standard that we've set and they do it? You learn when you actually have to be vulnerable and figure something out and grow, right? So it's like, to me, the irony of academic excellence is we're also kind of kneecapping the kids who give us that evidence. And this is, so Chris, you quoted me, so now I'm going to quote you. Chris has said one day so simply and clearly, belonging is not the same as privilege, right? Privilege is having advantages in a system that was designed for you, that expected you, right? It's as simple as the question. So if someone said to me, Allison, like, tell me about your husband, right? And first of all, just kind of designated my gender, put me in a heteronormative marriage. And then like, so privilege is something as simple as social exchanges that see me coming, that just expect me and ask me questions, pits to me. Then systemically, it's about designing schools, well-intended people, like Chris said, not dragging educators. We are educators. Schools being designed for kids who respond best to that circumstance. So that's privilege in a situation. The thing is, those kids are experiencing privilege, not necessarily belonging. This is like the lesson of Toni Morrison in The Bluest Eye. The child, the blondest, bluest-eyed girl, still isn't good enough someday, right? Is getting privileged in a system that likes these qualities, but isn't loved. And that's where belonging is really deep. We have to recognize that we're not loving the kids who are doing the best. We're just like rewarding them for doing what we wanted.
Okay, so why? So school says, a school, an institution says, cool. Well, that's great. That's what we're here for. Like, we're going to take the kid. This is what we do. And, you know, this is what we do. We do it well. We take the kids who do well at doing this. And, you know, the kids who do well at doing other things, well, they can go to another place that does those things well. And we, you know, sometimes we play around and we call them derogatory names like touchy-feely places or whatever. But you know, you guys, we create scientists, politicians, et cetera, world leaders, and they create teachers, or they create poets, or they whatever. So what's wrong with that? They
Chris,
say.
I just want to say, Chris, were you going to say something before?
Oh,
Okay. I love the honesty. So first of all, yes, let's just know what we're here for. Secondly, then David, my question is, okay, great. Once you've selected for what you think is a good match, and you know, like we hear it in hiring, like good fit and all these things, right?
Yeah.
Once you've selected and you think you've got a good match, how do you prepare to support and love and carry through on the promise that you have made when that student who is a human being falls?
Yeah.
Trip. So I'm all for, just be really honest. I'm not saying MIT admit people who have never looked at math before, right? But it's like, okay, so you got criteria, great. The question is, how do you carry through on your promise to the human being who in schools, and I don't care if they're over 18, they are still adolescents, right? At college, typically, but not always. How do you still hold your promise to them when they, in a very human way, are not perfectly what you hope and what they presented themselves to be?
And if I may, just piggybacking, and also, like, to your example about the school that goes like, that's absolutely fine. That's what we do. We produce poets. We produce philosopher kings at our, like, I don't care what it is. But there's also a case to be made about the preparatory aspects of an education. I don't like making it because I like focusing on the here and now for children. But to whatever degree you're trying to prepare philosopher kings to, you know, function in the world and issue by decree the moral and intellectual and practical judgment of your populace, it would be swell if said philosopher king had an actually cultivated understanding of how people might experience the world differently than they, and an acquired skill set at engaging with and thinking on empathetically on behalf of those the philosopher king is meant to serve. So I get it that you want to do this very unique, for lack of a more piercing word, thing with your school that may not align with my hopes for what a school would be. But there, I believe that the understandings and skills of this work are just as essential, even if the outcome is so limited and precise.
Yeah. I think you guys are nice, just nicer than me. I mean, I think for the most part, the answer to those places, the answer that given by those places to the question about what do you do when somebody falls, right? What do you do is, well, that's not what we're here for. When they fall, they go someplace else, or they go to a therapist, and if they can get the help they need, that's the problem. So really, underneath the call for belonging work, DEI work, right? You know, goodness work is a moral imperative, it seems to me. And on the one hand, hey, now I live in Wyoming, so I believe in freedom, right? So institutions can be what institutions want. And what a shame. And I know I've said this to parents over and over again, is like, look, you know, there are schools that do this really well. I mean, really well. They're phenomenal. But if human beings are this, even this, and chances are they're this, well, you know, then you have to make a decision about where you're going to put your child, where you're going to put yourself, because you might end up doing this thing really well, but I guarantee you, unless you're really unlucky, you're going to need this stuff in your life so much more often that, you know, maybe you'll get it then. But what a shame. What a shame.
I'm actually going to say, I think we just met, David, but I'm just going to go with, we're not nice. You're not nice. No, we're not nicer than you. I'm going to go with that because, well, Chris, I can say that about myself. And I think you as well. We're not in this for nice.
Chris, you're the nicest.
I think there's a humility that, so I've been doing consulting work for 20 years after being an educator. And to me, there's this humility about like the hugeness of what we're talking about,
yeah,
about systemic pressures on people who mean well and are under-supported structurally. That's the definition of a teacher. Under-supported to be a primary inspiration, guide, a comfort, cheerleader, coach,
yeah,
to a bunch of kids. And even if you happen to work in a independent school and you quote unquote only have 18 kids per class, you multiply that by four, we're still dealing with over 70 yeah souls, in, right?
Yes.
Well, and it, that's where the expression "it takes a village" comes from, yeah, right? But it's like the hugeness of some of the fundamental questions we need to ask. Chris and I are going to a conference where we're doing a session that's just, what are the questions that we need to be asking that we're not, because we just assume, or because they seem set, or it seems so obvious, or it doesn't seem like there are answers other than that's the way it is. Like, so just even getting people to the basic, if what you're really here for is pre-selecting for success to a specific and prestigious set of colleges, like let's just really focus there. Because the other thing that Chris and I are interested in is, like, we don't need to talk about this if DEI is really not vital. Now, the spoiler alert is, as Chris was pointing out, we can't see a way around. And this is the misunderstanding about DEI. And David, you pointed out, we actually need these terms. So people have said, let's not talk about diversity, it's too divisive, right? Or it was multiculturalism. No, it's equity and inclusion. No, it's justice. No, it's community, it's humanity. We just like moving on with the words. We actually need all the words. What we don't understand is the syntax, right? So here's the thing. All this work has been about and is about is actually safety, dignity, belonging, and thriving for everyone, not just some people in your community.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the core. Now, here's the thing. You can't control that. This is what infuriates us when people say this is a safe space. You can't tell someone what a safe space is. And by the way, when schools say David's office is a safe space for the kids, they're admitting that the rest of the campus is not, right? So first of all, you can't designate it. It can't be partial. But in the aspiration of safety, dignity, belonging, and thriving, and by the way, we can include the thriving of the institution because the kids have no place to go if this institution isn't thriving, certainly all the children and their adults. Toward that end, what you have to do is recognize the fundamental truth of diversity, which is differences within a group that activate disparities, patterns of disparity in their status, access to resources and opportunities, and in systemically activated privileges and disadvantages. Not just, I like cats, you like dogs, right? But the things that actually at a group level are demonstrating that there are different outcomes, different experiences, different access. And that's why you have to commit to equity and inclusion, which are two branches of justice, right? So that, and then we center this idea that what we really want is for everyone to truly thrive and for us to be able to predict it reliably, not saying, well, we know that the Asian kids will be fine, like implying who we know won't be fine. That's actually as problematic when you think you can just peg groups. Anytime you have to compare groups, ones that do well, better, worse, you're implying this inequality in the system. And so, yeah, I don't think the question for us is necessarily nice, but it just feels like there's so much static noise, smog in your point, educators being able to get to the big questions that are going to be so inconvenient because we need to renovate the house of education while people are living in it.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay, so now I'm going to do this thing, which is going to say we're reaching the end of time, and so at some point we'll stop. So I want to do this again. If there's a part two, I really want to do this again. This is so fun.
I would love to.
And so worthwhile. And I hope so important. God.
I would love that, David. And I love both of your minds. So there are no people with whom I'd rather do it.
Absolutely. Chris, I can't figure out. It's like, how is it? Maybe the question isn't, how is it that I learn so much every time you and I are in a conversation? But what am I doing in like a majority of my other relationships? And by the way, I don't actually mean that. I learn a lot from a lot of people, but it's like...
I never learn anything except in conversation with Chris.
Right back at you, number one. And number two is like I know that's a rhetorical question you're asking, but I think literally what we're doing is what we're talking about. Like,
yeah.
Like there are certain dimensions of our lives that are so profoundly different. And yet we have this common interest in a field and its implications and potential impacts that gives us hope. And like, there's just things that come to both of us together that will never come to either of us individually, precisely because of that proximity and engagement and difference. And like that's, yeah. I feel like that's literally a token of the type of thing we're talking about as part of the educative experience and trying to, you know, I want other people to feel what we feel when we're having these breakdowns, you know?
Mm. No, for real, because it's like what I understand about jazz, right? It's like you have a group of people who have picked up instruments before, right? Or they've sung before. And so I think of that every time I hear you speak, Chris, because like I hear the fundamental knowledge that you bring and the fact that you're applying it in context, in a dialogue and in a group project. So yeah, absolutely. It's like, the idea that kids would be able to feel, and this is Zaretta Hammond, right? That they're bringing their prior knowledge and that it is meaningful and that they're seeing what they think they understand in a new context and in more deeply, and that they're learning from other people. I think that's what we're getting at, both as like, isn't that a beautiful idea about education? And like, that is what belonging in education looks like.
You know, that's so... I've spent a lot of years in schools, and I'm not sure. I think I would run. No, I think I'd have enough fingers. I don't even have to go to toes. The numbers of times I could say that was a feeling in the room, and that's really what a shame that it's not. Always like that.
You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.